Okay, it's 9 o'clock on my clock here, so I want to begin. Today is this should be the last class we have on Rebbitzel Chulin Spector. I'm going to try to finish it, and if I need to go 5 or 10 minutes after, I'll do that because I do want to finish today, and I should be able to finish. And then we'll be able to start fresh next semester. But before we start, a number of people sent me things, and I just want to take 5 minutes and comment. And as always, I'll get to the questions at the end. There's a very learned man who's been listening to a number of the old tapes, and he corrected me about something that's not from last semester, but even the semester before. So I want to make note of that. In discussing Pressburg, I referred to Rabbi Akiva Sofer as the last Rav of Pressburg. And he actually had a son named Avram Shmuel Binyamin, same name as the Ketav Sofer. And I was of the opinion that although he was involved with the yeshiva, he was not actually officially Rav of the community. But that's incorrect. His father, the Dat Sofer, Akiva Sofer, went to the land of Israel in 1939 at the end, around September, August. And his son was officially the Rav for the next 3.5 or so years. That's known as the Cheshev Sofer. So just make that correction. He also pointed out that my description I spoke about last semester of Meir Simcha of Divinsk. I mentioned that he deals with the Maimonides' view of sacrifices, that it's just to keep you away from idolatry, and Nachmanides' opposing position. And I said that Rav Meir Simcha understands the Rambam, his view of sacrifices, to just be referring to the Bamot, not those in the temple. And then I asked the question, but if you look in the Mor Nevuchim, it's clear that even the whole Beis HaMikdash is regarded as a concession, according to Maimonides. So I left it as a question on the Or Sameach. And the way I explained the Meshech Chachma is how I looked online. Plenty of people explain it this way, but Shimon, who emailed me, I now believe he's correct. I looked again. What the Meshech Chachma is doing, he's not actually explaining the Rambam. He's actually making a pashara, a compromise. You have the Rambam's position that idolatry, that the sacrifices are just a concession to the people who are connected to this form of worship, and you have Nachmanides' opinion that sacrifices are exalted. He's not actually saying that he uses the word v'yeshel hachriya. He's actually deciding for himself, it seems to me now, and I think Shimon's right, that that's his own opinion. He takes a little from the Rambam, and he takes a little from Nachmanides, and says that the Rambam's right when it comes to the Bamot, Nachmanides is right when it comes to the obligatory sacrifices. So I take back what I said. It's a very interesting interpretation. It's his own interpretation, but he doesn't mean to say that the Rambam actually holds that, although, as I mentioned, and I showed it to Shimon, there are people online, at least we found one very easily, and then I found others who think that he's trying to explain the Rambam, but I don't think so. And Shimon showed me that Chavel doesn't either. Okay, with regard to last class, also a couple of things before we start. It was pointed out to me correctly, I said that Satmar, the meaning of the term, is small village. It's actually a great village. I contacted Bill, mentioned, we spoke about girls getting pregnant before marriage in a pre-modern time where people would find that hard to believe. And Bill referred to the Note of Yehuda. He thought it made reference to Italy. It's actually in Mahadura Kama, the first edition, Ebn Ezer, Simon Zion. But he doesn't speak about Italy there. He says, Bavanoteno harabim bimadinot halalu. He's speaking about Central Europe, Hadavar Matsoi. That is, you often find these premarital pregnancies. Two more things. I contacted Yaakov Shulman. I forgot who it was. I think it was maybe Yossi, who's down there. Yossi M. mentioned that in 1994, Yaakov Shulman published a book about Eliyahu Kramer. So I contacted him because we were talking about this Eliyahu Kramer. Where did he ever get the idea that the Vilna Gaon's last name was Eliyahu Kramer? And he said to me he thinks he got the information from the book Hagon HaChassid MiVilna, which is a famous biography written a number of years ago on the Gra. Needless to say, there's nothing in there about that in it, but that leads me to believe that maybe Shulman Is it possible that 19 years ago, Shulman is the origin of this common expression, Eliyahu Kramer? Because he uses it, he thinks it's in Landau's book, Hagona Chassid Mivilna. What Landau does say is he mentions the name Kramer, but the name Kramer is Rav Moshe Kramer, based in Vilna. I have the whole genealogy here now. The other Gadol of Vilna was Rav Moshe Rifkus, who was the Ber Hagola. They made a shidduch between them. The son of Rav Moshe Kramer married the granddaughter of Rav Moshe Rifkus, his son named Eliyahu. He had three sons. One of those sons was the father of the Vilna Gaon. So Rav Moshe Kramer, if I get this right, is the great-great-grandfather of the Vilna Gaon. Let's see, Rav Moshe Kramer, his son's Eliyahu. Eliyahu's son is Yisachar Ber. Yisachar Ber is the father of Shlomo Zalman, who's the grandfather of the Gra. So you can figure it out. It's grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, I think, of the Gra. But that's it for Kramer. Okay, let us begin with Rabbi Yitzchak Ochanan. A lot to say. We ended last class dealing with his relationship to Chovah Beit Zion. I think I might have left a mistaken impression by if people think that everyone involved in Chovah Beit Zion at the time period we're talking about, the 1890s, was religious. That's not the case at all. In fact, the movement itself, in its leadership positions, was a non-religious movement. You had guys like Pinsker and others who were involved. However, there were rabbis involved, and even these non-religious people were under the assumption at this time that the settlements in the land of Israel would have to be run according to halakha. There were many rabbis who were not involved in the movement per se. Like Rabbi Yitzchak Ochanan was not officially a member of it, as we spoke about. Rav Moliver was, and others were, but there were many rabbis involved and many others who supported it, but it was not like it was 30 years before in the days of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, where it was almost entirely religious. And that's how we ended last class, with Rabbi Yitzchak Ochanan as a great supporter living in the Land of Israel settlement. So it makes sense, therefore, knowing his support for the settlement of the Land of Israel, that he would be approached and asked to issue a heter mechira, permission to sell the land in the Land of Israel in the sabbatical year so that the colonists would not starve and they'd be able to stay on the land. Not to mention the fact that he was the leading posek of his day. The year is 1889. That's the Shemitah year. But of course, it's 1888 that they have to repair all this. Now, the basis for this heter, I mean, what's the problem? Well, first of all, we know we can't work the land during the sabbatical year. Well, we're coming up to Pesach, and we know what we do with the chametz. So there's always been this thought that if you needed to, you could engage in one of these sort of tricks to sell the land. I call it a trick, harama, you can call it, but technically it's permissible, according to many, especially if you assume that today the sabbatical year is only of rabbinic authority, not of Torah authority. And in the days of the Netziv and of Rabbi Yitzchak Ochanan, everyone assumed that it was either rabbinic or it was Torah law. There was an opinion of the Baal Hamor that today there is no obligation at all to do the sabbatical year. It's just sort of like a minhag, it's zecher le'alma. But since that was an individual opinion, no one took it seriously. It's interesting that today we know differently. Today, we know that there are other authorities who hold it. The Me'iri, for example, if I'm not mistaken, the Sefer Ha'itim, there's a whole group of Rishonim we now know, at least five of them, I think, four or five important ones. So you can look in Diane Grunfeld, and one of his volumes deals with it. Rabbi Kasher deals with it. Rav Zevin and his Lor HaLacha deals with it. And they quote these new Rishonim, which they didn't know about 130 years ago, 140 years ago, which, on the one hand, you know, adds more support for the sale of the land in the sabbatical year. So that was the issue that was raised. And for those who are going to permit it, the big thing and the reason you could have this permission is precisely it makes it a lot easier that it's a rabbinical prohibition not to work the land. Furthermore, though, we know that there's a problem. You're not supposed to sell the land in the Land of Israel to non-Jews. And that, for some, would be enough of a problem to close off the solution. However, there's openings as well, because what's the reason you can't sell it? You have early sources that speak about, you even look in the Torah, in perpetuity. You're not supposed to sell it to them permanently. So if it was a temporary sale, there would be room to permit, according to some. Furthermore, you have to ask yourself, what's the reason why you can't sell the land in the sabbatical year? And if you, again, if you look at early sources, we usually don't try to argue based upon reasons. You know, you have a halacha and that's it. But if you look at some of these sources, they speak about how because the Gentiles will contaminate the land with their idolatry, with their avodah zarah. That leads to the implication, according to many, that if you sell it to a monotheist, there's no prohibition. And the Muslims, who the sale would be to, are monotheists, and they would not fall under the prohibition, which was designed for pagans and things like that. So that's the issue. Well, the important figures who dealt with the sabbatical year sale and the sabbatical year problem in 1888 were all active in Chovevei Tzion. You have the Nitziv. You have Rav Moliver, who we spoke about last class. You have Rav Mordechai Eliasberg and others. And the Heter Mechira, this plan to sell this land during the sabbatical year, split the Chovevei Tzion rabbis into two camps. The Nitziv, who was a great supporter of settlement in the land of Israel, it's no accident that his son, Meir Bar-Ilan, is the head of Mizrahi, the Nitziv was opposed. He thought that we now have the opportunity to establish settlements in the land of Israel. We must do the mitzvah of Shemitah in its proper fashion. He saw the return to the land of Israel as a great merit, a great zechut, but only if it's done properly. The returnees to Zion have to follow halacha properly, and he thought that if they commit to following halacha, enough charitable donations will arrive from the diaspora that they will be taken care of. So there was a dispute. The Nitziv on the one side, and other as well as other rabbis, but he was the most important, and other rabbis on the other side, and most importantly, Rav Moliver, Rav Mordechai Eliasberg, and they turned to the Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, because they feel that although they are in support of a Heter Mechira, that they need the authority of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. After acquainting himself with the situation, and being influenced by the Chovevei Tzion and by the rabbis, especially by Rabbi Moliver, who had influence on Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, as well as his son, Ritzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz. This is the son of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. His last name is Rabinowitz. I'll talk about that last name later today. And Rabinowitz supported the Heter Mechira. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan is ready to sign on to the Heter Mechira. But he then receives a letter from signed by two people. One is Rav Shmuel Salant, who's the Rav of the Ashkenazim in Jerusalem and really in the land of Israel. And also this is signed by Rabbi Diskin, Moshe Levi Yeshua Diskin, telling him not to sign, not to give his permission for this Heter Mechira. It would be a great breach. And they, as the Rabbanim in the land of Israel, oppose this. So when Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan gets this letter by the rabbis on the ground, he backtracks, and he's not going to have any part in the Heter Mechira, and you would think that this would end all the discussion. Because if the rabbis on the spot, on the ground, are opposing it, and these are not small rabbis, these are important rabbis, especially Shmuel Salant, who came from Lithuania, they both came from Lithuania, that would be the end of it. However, as 1888 continues, the Chovevei Tzion people start getting very nervous. They believed, and they weren't just making it up, that this was a real question of pikuach nefesh, of saving life. There was fears of real starvation for the people in these new settlements. And they needed an answer. Rav Moliver was joined by Rav Yisrael Yoshua Trunk of Kutno. He's the author of the famous commentary on the Rambam, Yoshua's Malko. And another Rav, in addition to the ones I've mentioned already, Rav Shmuel Zamvil Klepfish, one of the leading rabbis of Warsaw. These three were really outstanding figures, more than Rav Mordechai Eliasberg. I mean, these were three great poskim. That's the Yeshua Smalko, Rav Moliver, and Rav Shmuel Zonvel Klepfish. And they decided on their own to issue the Heter Mechira. They don't need anyone else. They're enough of authorities. And the contract to sell the land was to be done by the based in Jerusalem on the authorities of these rabbis. What they said, however, is that their heter is dependent on Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan going along with it. and they sent in the documentation. So understand, the Heter Mechira is the Heter Mechira of these three great rabbis, conditional on Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan agreeing with them. In other words, they put Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan on the spot, and they let him know that this was vital, it was a shat hadchak, an emergency. So that's maybe difficult for Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan being put on the spot, but on the other hand, his position is made easier. Since he now is not responsible for the heter, he only has to give his approval to a heter which was developed by three other gedolim. And when Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan saw the other three gedolim's signature on the letter, he went along and agreed with the heter and signed on. And everyone remembers this as the heter of Yitzchak Elchanan's specter, which it was not. It was the heter of those three rabbis that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan agreed to it. Although originally he was going to be the one to write the decision, he backed off, but he was willing to sign on to the decision by the others, and he mentions that the sale should only be to Muslims. He also states that he wrote a kuntras, a little booklet, or a responsum on the topic, that is before, it's not clear whether he wrote it when he was approached by Rav Oliver. I think it's more likely that he wrote it originally when he was about to issue the heter, and then he got the letter from Rabbi Salant and Rabbi Diskin. But he says he didn't publish it. Actually, that's what he says. He says he didn't publish it because he didn't want to be the only one to permit it. So he originally, when he was going to permit it before, he wrote the responsum, and then he did not publish it because he got the letter from Rabbi Salant and Rabbi Diskin. He kept it, and then So then he signs on to this, and you have four great gedolim of Lithuania permitting the sale, as I mentioned, opposed by the Nesiv and others. He still doesn't publish his responsum. Why not? We have letters from him supporting the Heter Mechira, but he doesn't publish his responsum. And none of the biographies, none of the articles written on him mention why he didn't publish it. However, I published it in my doctoral dissertation, the appendix. A letter from Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg that he testifies that this was during the Shlita dispute when he wrote his responsum permitting stunning animals before Shlita. I don't think I can't remember now if I ever printed. I printed a number of letters of Rabbi Weinberg and Hamayan. I can't remember if this is one of them. But Rabbi Chaim Moshe Grzinski prevailed upon him not to publish his responsum permitting stunning before Shlita. And in this conversation, so reports Rabbi Weinberg, Rav Chaim Ozer told him that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan also had a situation like this, where he was going to, where he actually went further, because he actually permitted l'maaseh, unlike Rabbi Weinberg with the stunning, he permitted the sale of the land during the Shemitah year, but he never published his responsum, his heter, because he didn't want it to be a psak l'dorot. He didn't want it to be a permanent thing. And as we'll see, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was insistent that every single Shemitah, this has to be re-examined anew. If he would publish it and put it into print, that would turn it into something of permanent validity, and that he didn't want. So said Rav Chaim Moshe Grzinski. We spoke in the previous class about a similar case where the Chafetz Chaim refused to put something in print for the similar reason. So now that, as I said, now that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, at the end, I'll come back to questions towards the end, comments. Now that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan sees the other rabbis giving the heter, waiting for him to make it conditional on him, he goes along, stating it's only for 1889. As you can imagine, the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael, that is Rabbi Salant and Rabbi Diskin, and those who were in their circle, which was the Ashkenazic Rabbanim, they were very upset. And rightfully so. Because here, they are the rabbis in the land. They are the Marad Asra. And how can another rabbi, even great rabbis, from outside the land of Israel, issue a psak in their territory? You can imagine how they're feeling, that these rabbis from outside are coming into our territory and issuing a psak. However, those three rabbis, and Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, Rav Oliver, Rav Shmuel Zalman Klepfish, and Yeshua Smalko, they did not regard Rav Shmuel Salant and Rabbi Diskin as the Marad Asra, as the authorities. As far as they were concerned, they were the authorities in Jerusalem for the old Yishuv, this group of people who lived on the Chalukah system, who lived on charity from abroad. That was their group. However, the colonists who had recently come in, These were different types of people. These were people working for a living, not people surviving on charity. These were people who needed different types of rabbis because they were in different types of communities. So, therefore, they had no problem issuing a psak for these people because these people looked towards the rabbis who supported them, the Chovev Etzion rabbis, the rabbis who encouraged them to go to the land of Israel, the rabbis who were responsible for raising money for them, and Rabbi Salanter, Rabbi Diskin. They had nothing to do with the colonists. They got money sent to them in this kolel system they had, and they distributed it. I have a piece of paper, actually, about this over here. I'll get it later if we have time. Well, what about the other fact? That the Heter has to be put in practice by the Basin of Jerusalem. That's the Basin in the land of Israel. The only real Basin in the land of Israel at this time. And practically, that's the only way for it to work. And Rabbi Salant and Rabbi Diskin, who were from the Basin, they refused to have anything to do with it. They even organized a Vod Hashmita, which said, we will raise money and we will support you colonists if you observe Shemitah. And we know that there were some who tried to observe it. The Netziv tells us this. The Netziv, who's a great opponent of the Heter Mechidra, says that some tried to observe the Shemitah, but they were not able to. In other words, they would starve. Literally, they would starve. And they were forced, therefore, to rely on the Heter. But from the Netziv's perspective, the reason it came to this sad circumstance was precisely because the rabbis in Chutzlaris, the other rabbis, issued the Heter Mechidra. So no one's giving tzedakah to the colonists, because their attitude is, if you can rely on the Heter Mechira, but as far as the Netziv is concerned, if Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan and the rest would have opposed the Heter Mechira and instead would have supported, organized a campaign to support the colonists, then things would have been very different. Well, what was the solution then? I do want to show you this paper. Hold on a second. I'll never find it. Sorry. So what were they to do then? Since the Ashkenazic Basin wouldn't go along with it. Well, they did something very interesting. They turned to the Sephardic Basin. We all think of Jerusalem. We think of, Rabbi Salant, Rabbi Diskin, and the rest, Rabbi Sonnenfeld. If he hasn't come yet, he comes very soon after. There was also a Sephardic community there. A community, by the way, which was not a community dependent on charity. It was a community of people who worked Arabic-speaking, led by a what's called a Rishon Lezion, a great, great Torah sage, Yaakov Shal El Yashar. The rabbis turned to the Sephardic Basin and said that, and the Sephardic Basin agreed with them that you can sell the land. And the Sephardic Basin arranged the Heter Mechira. The Rabbi Trunk, the Yeshua Smalko, even goes overboard. I mean, you have these rabbis of Eastern Europe. They live an entire lifetime, to 80, 90 years old. They literally have never met a Sephardi in their life. And they had this sort of there was an exoticness to the Sephardic rabbis, and they built them up as these great authorities. Rabbi Trunk says that how these Sephardic rabbis are much greater than us. He uses a rabbinic expression that their fingernails are greater than us, our whole bodies. But again, it's this exotic idea, so that the Sephardic rabbis are much greater, and they turn to them, and Yaakov Shal Yashar and his Basin. They take care of the Heter Mechira. And this wasn't something new for them, because although there hadn't been settlements in the land of Israel in a long time, a few hundred years before, there was a Sephardic Rav in Hebron. He wrote a volume of Tshuvot called Shemen HaMa'or, and he permitted the sale of land to get around Shemitah. So this wasn't something new for the Sephardim. You had a couple hundred years ago, in Hebron, you had people who had small plots of land, and he permitted it, so there was already a Sephardic tradition. What's significant about this is it's even pointed out by Rav Yashir in one of his responsa is that there was literally not one Sephardi living in the colonies, and in those days everything was divided Ashkenazi and Sephardi, and yet nevertheless the Sephardic rabbis take care of it and issue the heter for the colonists, not the Ashkenazim. Now Rav Yitzchak Chanan's great sympathy for the settlers is obviously important when it came to the Heter Mechira. The first Shemitah, by the way, let me just tell you, the first Shemitah with a modern community was not 1889, it was 1882. There were people in Petach Tikva, but no Heter was needed for them because what happened is there was a malaria plague and other diseases, and everyone leaves the settlement. And the settlement, by the time the Shemitah comes around, there's no one there to work the land. But by 1889, you had an established settlement in Petach Tikva and other places also. Now, Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan lived for one more Shemitah, 1896. And in this year, things were so bad, they were even worse, that Rabbi Diskin, not Rabbi Salant, although that some people say that he didn't protest, I haven't investigated it, so I can't say, but Rabbi Salant, what his position was, we'll have classes around Salant, then we'll get to the bottom of it, but Rabbi Diskin goes along with the Heter in 1896. This idea that Rabbi Yochanan, that he bends over backwards to help the poor colonists, this really is part of his persona. He was always concerned with the poor. Let me read you something that comes from translation from a biography about him, the biography of Lifshitz. We mentioned Yaakov Lifshitz, Zichron Yaakov. He tells how Rabbi Yochanan's son, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz, was once very ill, and Rabbi Yochanan offered the following prayer on his recovery. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Master of the Universe, you know that all these years I served in the rabbinate, numerous questions came to me concerning Agunot, Shochtim, whom the community wanted to disqualify, the Shochtim they wanted to disqualify. In all these cases, I labored very strongly to find a heter for these unfortunate people, especially for those with family responsibilities. Therefore, God, have mercy on me and my son, who's a father of young children. So you see there, Rabbi Yochanan, in his prayer to God, he says to God that I've worked for the little person, the aguna, the shochet, who, for whatever reason, they want to get rid of him and his children depend on him. There's another story that's told, I see here, that... I don't even want to read you stories, but stories about Agunot, Rabbi Yochanan bending over backwards. Let me read you in Ephraim Shimoff's little biography of Rabbi Yochanan. He writes as follows. It's quite evident that the major difference between Rabbi Yochanan and his contemporaries in reference to difficult questions was that the former, that is Rabbi Yochanan, when confronted with a complicated question, the other rabbis, when confronted with a complicated question, saw before them the Talmud and its commentaries, the Shulchan Aruch, etc. And Rabbi Yochanan saw the man with his perplexities, the woman with her anxieties. He therefore employed the Talmud and Shulchan Aruch to come to their aid. Don't think, however, that Rabbi Yochanan was always a Mekil. He often was. He was known as a great lenient person, but not always. And he actually went up again against Maskilim, who wanted to get rid of the Kitni Oath prohibition. Kitniot is soon upon us, and someone had an interesting post a little while ago, Rabbi Konevsky, that we should be thankful for our quinoa, because who knows how much longer we're going to have our quinoa. And if you think quinoa can't go the way of the dodo, look at peanuts and peanut oil and everything. So be thankful every year for our quinoa, he says. But kitniot, which is a prohibition or a minhag, it's not clear what it is, but it's something Ashkenazim follow. It's always been something that you could get rid of temporarily if there's famine or difficulties. And in 1869, there was a famine in Lithuania, and he permitted kitniot, Rabbi Yochanan. And this was difficult for him to permit, because there were maskilim also who said it should be permitted, and they thought that the whole prohibition was foolish and should be gotten rid of. So here you have a situation where things are getting difficult, people need food, and the maskilim are talking about how stupid kitniot are, and they should be gotten rid of entirely. Most rabbis, it was easier for them, because if maskilim are arguing for something, and they're going to take this and run with it, just to say forbidden, forbidden. For Rabbi Yochanan, no. He permits the kitniot, knowing then he has to challenge the maskilim and balance this against saying that don't think maskilim that this means I'm getting rid of it permanently, just for this year. And the maskilim, even when they didn't say they wanted to get rid of it permanently, even when they just spoke about how difficult it was this year, they did want to get rid of it permanently. They looked to people like Rabbi Yaakov Emden, and who thought it was a foolish custom. They knew the history of it. They knew that the custom had enlarged and enlarged, and if they were only living today, they'd see how much more it enlarged. And there is a backlash against kitniot in Israel right now. It's become very common today in Israel for people to use kitniot derivatives, which we'll see in a minute. I'm not going to say that's necessarily a heter, but because we'll see the man you're looking at in the picture is responsible for that, but it had been out of fashion for a long time. But Rabbi Yochanan, knowing it was a case of really pikuach nefesh, that people didn't have what to eat, he stuck with his heter against many big-name rabbis. He was worried that since the other great rabbis of the day, for the most part, opposed him on the Kitneil prohibition. That is, they said, and they were influenced by the Maskilim. You know, if you don't have the Maskilim arguing against Kitneil, it's a lot easier to permit it. It's like with the Orthodoxy in America. If you didn't have the conservative rabbis pushing bat mitzvahs, the Orthodox would have been able to permit it 30, 40 years ago before they did. They would have been able to permit prenuptial agreements. It's natural that when someone is who you oppose is trying to permit it, there's a reaction. So Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, in order to counter these other rabbis who opposed his permission, he announced that he and his family and all the important people around him are going to be eating kitnios. And he also turned to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and got Rabbi Yisrael Salanter to sign on to join the Heter, which he did. It's a very smart thing, because whenever you have a situation like that, people always suspect, well, you know, that's very nice, but maybe it's not a Heter for us. Maybe it's just a Heter for the masses. But we're yeshiva people, or we're pious people, and it doesn't apply to us. And, you know, sometimes you have rabbis, they'll give hashkachas on something, but they personally don't eat it. And so this way, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan made sure that everyone knew that he's eating the kitnios. He also did something else. He writes a responsum permitting kitnio derivatives, which, as far as I know, is the first written responsum. I can't say if he's the first one. I can't imagine that he's the first, but I can't tell from his responsum, and I don't know of any other responsum, but I think he is the first one to put it in writing, permitting kidney oat liquid derivatives. If the kidney oat are carefully searched before Pesach and you make sure there's no grain, that is, you have kidney oats and you make sure there's no grain in it, so when you make it, there's no chametz in there, that is permissible. For the simple reason that this is a custom or a practice that's been instituted, but it was only instituted on the actual items. If you look in any of the medieval sources, or even late early modern sources, none of them mention anything about, you know, the kitnios derivatives or anything like that. And therefore, why assume that it's forbidden? When you have a thing like this, you can start with two assumptions. You can start on the assumption that everything is forbidden if it's connected in any way to kitnios, unless you have reason to permit, or you can start with the assumption that everything's permitted unless we have a practice to forbid. When it comes to peanuts, for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, everything is permitted, this is permitted, unless the practice is to forbid. Others say just the opposite. And this idea of kitnios derivatives being permissible becomes widely accepted. Shimshon Rafal Hirsch permits it, or the Sri Deyesh, in Eretz Yisrael, the big rabbis do. And even in America, the OU used to give hashkacha to this. I think around 30 years ago, they stopped. I can't figure out why they don't give. Now they're giving hashkacha products under hashkacha that say for kitnios. They started with a few. So if you're going to do that, then of course you can give with kitnios derivatives. And also, here's something you should know. If you see a product in the store that has hashkacha on it, and it says for people who eat kitnios, that is sfardim, but if you look at the ingredients, and the only kitnios are peanuts, that is, it's peanuts oil, and you're one of the old Lithuanians, because in Lithuania, everyone ate peanuts on Pesach, you can buy that product. It's 100% permissible. It is the first time, this year will be the first time we, in America, that is, that we have peanuts under the peanut products under the hashkacha of the OU in 30 years or so. Feel free to get it. But here's something you've seen, I'm sure, in the supermarkets. Anyone ever see these things? Joyva products, Joyva chocolate covered marshmallows. It used to be that during the year they were under the Chafkei hashkacha, but on Pesach, they were under Rabbi Sheinkopf's hashkacha. Now, I see them in the supermarket. It seems like all I see is Rabbi Sheinkopf's hashkacha. So why do I mention this? Well, they're marshmallows. It says fish gelatin, so anyone could eat it. I don't know if you could see it. Because he used to give hashkacha to this years ago when it was regular gelatin. His father was Rav Moshe Don Sheinkopf, by the way, who was from Massachusetts, one of the big rabbanim in America years ago. So why do I mention this? Because when you're in a supermarket and if you want to look at this, my kids like it, so I buy it. Not for Pesach. I can't bring it to the hotel, but I eat it. You know, they sell it. They sell it in my town. They sell it all year. It's in the, not only do they sell it, it's in the under Rabbi Sheinkopf's Ashkacha, it's in the, we have a special kosher aisle in my supermarket, which is the Vod of, the Vod's aisle. That is, they don't, triangle K is not in there, those sorts of things. So, they approve, the Vod approves what can go in that aisle, and, the Joiva stuff is in the aisle. So I guess, according to our Vod, it's okay, although I don't know about for Pesach. But on the back, this is what it says. Because this is the ingredients. The ingredients is sugar, corn syrup. And yet, it has Ashkacha for kosher Pesach. I don't recall ever seeing such a notice on any other type of box of food. Quote, please note, : liquefied legumes extracts, for example, corn syrup, in kosher for Passover foods, are fully sanctioned for Ashkenazim and Sephardim alike by preeminent Orthodox halachic authorities, including the renowned Posek Hador, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. I think the average housewife who's going to the supermarket who picks this up, she's probably never heard of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, so I don't know if that means anything to her, but that's what Rabbi Sheinkopf put. But he didn't just do that. If those who are interested in the topic further, he wrote an entire book, or Sefer, he's a Chaim Berlin Musmach, also PhD from Revel, Issues in Jewish Dietary Laws, Gelatin, Kidney Oat, and Their Derivatives. Rabbi David I. Sheinkopf, he just came out with a new edition. This one I'm holding here is 1988. In 2010, he came out with a new edition, and he also discusses in there Carmine. Carmine is not your local Italian deli or anything. Carmine is that red stuff which they put in. It comes from the skin of a beetle, which gives things color. So what's the kashrus standing of that? Because it's the form has totally changed. I haven't seen the book yet, but I might be mentioned in it because I sent him, I know him a bit, I sent him Rav Avad Yosef's tshuva, which permits all gelatin. And he told me that he's going to polemicize against that responsum because Sheinkopf makes the case in this book and the new book that it's only gelatin from meat, from beef, that's kosher, and the products. He gives hashkacha, for example, the dan and yogurt. But from pig skin, which Rav Avadya says it's okay, he says that's absolutely incorrect. And furthermore, he says that, he said to me, Rav Avadya Yosef, and I assume he's correct, Rav Avadya Yosef has never been in a plant. He's never seen production of gelatin. And therefore, this is not a case of where you're going to say Rav Avadya Yosef is greater, as he obviously is, than Rabbi David Sheinkopf. It's a question of who knows the Metzius, and that's always an issue. And if Rabbi Sheinkopf is correct, then Rabbi Avadya Yosef doesn't know the Metzius. So we have someone, I mean, if he doesn't know the Metzius, then it's questionable whether you can rely on him. We have with us now Bill Gewirtz, he's listening, I see. He's a great expert in math. You can speak to him that on the calendar. What do? You have many Gedolei Yisrael who were wrong scientifically. They didn't understand certain mathematical things, and maybe their calculations for when Shabbos is over is incorrect, therefore. I mean, you have a situation sometimes where the greatest of authorities make these sorts of errors. And at least according to Rabbi Sheinkopf, Rav Avadya, he not only does he think he's wrong in the halakha per se, that is just interpretation, but he thinks, which I wouldn't, you know, pay much mind to that, because, you know, just in terms of learning of Torah, fine, Rabbi Sheinkopf can make the case, but if you're going to put Rabbi Avadya Yosef's understanding of the sources in Rabbi Sheinkopf, who's going to argue that you can certainly rely on Rabbi Avadya Yosef? Yeshal miwis al miwis moch, as they say in that video, maybe some of you have seen about the Shiva video, where Shtik Yeshiva guys say during Shiva, Yesh al miwis moch. However, if Rabbi Sheinkopf is correct, that Rav Avadya Yosef doesn't know the reality of how gelatin is really made. And therefore, that led him to permit pig skin, and that's a different circumstance. But as I faxed to Rabbi Sheinkopf, it's not just Rav Avadya Yosef. I sent him Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank's tshuva. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank is the first one to permit all gelatin, including pig skin. And to this day, the chief rabbinate relies on that. So, but if you want to know, we're in the season now, if you want to know about kidney oat and you want to read in English, for those who are reading in English, there's two things to read. One is the very nice chapter in Rav Zevin's Hamoedim B'Halacha, the festivals in Halacha. He discusses the whole issue. And the other is Rabbi Sheinkopf's work on it. And people have told me that today, because, first of all, it's hard to get products without kidney oats in Israel. The Sephardim are the majority. And therefore, although Ashkenazi, most Ashkenazim still hold by it, because other than this iconoclastic Rabbi David Bar Chaim, no Ashkenazi posek has said you can get rid of kitniot, they've gone back to the old way of eating kitniot derivatives, corn syrup and all these sorts of things. And I've also heard, I don't know how accurate it is, but Rabbi C. Leshem recently wrote about this, that many people now have also gone back to the strict halakha, according to many, that if kitniot are mixed, that is, if they're in a mixture, and you can't really make it out, we know that kitniot are batel barov, or in a, so if a Sfaradi makes a dish, let's say a pie, and in the pie, kitniot are mixed in it, and you're invited over, according to many, you can eat it, because even though they made it intentionally, it didn't just fall in, that's the old question in Yoredeya, you know, if someone makes it as part of the procedure, is it batel? And many hold it can be. But for those of you listening who are not interested, who don't hold by kitniot derivatives, you hold by Rabbi Sheinkopf, I mean, you don't need to buy the special Coke, which, well, I actually check it out, but the issue, as far as I know, is just the corn syrup. Let's go on. I want just a few other things I want to point out that have been in the news and are relevant to us. The volume came out not too long ago, Letters of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. This is not really a new volume in the sense that you have new material in here. Almost all these letters appeared elsewhere, but the editor did a very nice job of bringing them together from the very, he went through the old newspapers and various Sfarim. Well, in volume one, on page 275-276, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan is asked about Metzitza. That's been in the news a lot. Metzitza and Metzitza Bepeh. Because this isn't just a new thing that people were concerned about illnesses and the government. And on page number 91, page 275, he responds that you asked me about Metzitza, that the government does not allow, we don't know what country he's writing to here, because he's writing to someone else. It could be in Germany there are places they didn't allow us, that is various states in Germany. The government does not allow the Moalim to do Metzitza with their mouth because it's dangerous. And you want to know my opinion, can you do it with a that tube? And you, Rabbi so-and-so, he doesn't say who it is, permit it. In my opinion, we also permit it, and you can fulfill the mitzvah this way. If you're in a place where the government doesn't allow it, so what's the question? Obviously, you don't have a choice. No, you do have a choice. You might say that if you think that metzitza b'peh with the mouth is part of the essence of the mitzvah and has to be done, well, then you won't give the baby a circumcision at 8 days if you can't. You'll travel to another place where you can do it that way, or you'll wait till you can go. Maybe the baby's not healthy enough at 8 days, but at 30 days you'll go and you'll do the bris milah then in another place, or you'll do it secretly. You'll take the chance. Yes, if you're caught, you could be punished. But if this is the mitzvah, you'll do it secretly. These are all the other options. But if there's really no prohibition against doing it, then you don't need to do this, put yourself in such a situation. Now, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan agrees, and this was the standard psak in Lithuania, that if there's medical issues, forget the government. You know, you don't even need the government. If there's medical issues, the standard psak in Lithuania was that you do it with the kli. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan wasn't dealing with medical issues. There weren't any medical issues there. They were dealing with the government as a preventive measure, like today, said that you can't do it. By World War II, by Rav Chaim Moser tells us that although the rabbis were not happy with us, there was plenty of Moalim who didn't even do Metzitza at all, and Metzitza B'peh was standard. On the next page, he writes to a Rav in Hamburg, and there he says again he permits doing it with the tube, but he makes it clear that you know, we should do it the way we've been accustomed to doing it, that is, mouth with the mouth, unless the government doesn't permit us. Then you do it with a tube. But he doesn't say we have to fight for it. It's not a question of religious freedom or anything like that. But if you have a choice, you do it the way it's supposed to be done. I meant, if I said Metzitza B'peh was standard, that's correct. I didn't mean standard. I meant it was not standard in Lithuania in the years before the war. There were people who did it, no question about it, but it was not, it was pretty standard not to do it. By World War II, we know in the big cities that it wasn't. As we spoke about, the Maskilim thought highly of Rabbi Zohanan. And therefore, they often thought that he was on their side. And when he wasn't, he was playing this dance, almost, between those Maskilim who he was friendly with and those Maskilim who he thought was dangerous. It depended on each Maskil. But there's a good story of one of these Maskilim who heard, you know, they heard about Rabbi Zohanan, how he's so moderate and liberal, and he meets him, and he sees an old-fashioned Rav and Posek. And this is an apocryphal story, but I think it illustrates a lot. He says to Rabbi Zohanan, you know, I'm such an admirer of yours. I heard so many good things about you. And yet I thought you were of the new generation, the Dor Chadash. But now I see you are of the Dor Yashan, the old generation. I'm telling you this story because we're coming up to Pesach. Rabbi Zohanan replies, indeed, I am of the new generation. As we say in the Haggadah, in the beginning, our forefathers were idol worshippers. So I'm the new generation. I'm not the idol worshiper. I think the implication is that you guys, you're not the new generation. I'm the Torah generation. The old generation is the idolaters. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was, however, in one area he stood out as not being lenient. And he was a leader of a stringent position. In modern times, we have something we never had before in any real numbers. And that is the aguna. And I'm not referring to the aguna the man is lost at sea. I'm referring to what you can call the man-made aguna. The man just refuses to give his wife a get. He goes to America, promises he'll send for her when he establishes himself. This is quite common. And then he decides as soon as he gets on the boat, he's rid of that, annoying shrew. And he's going to take up with someone else in America. And in the newspapers of America in the last part of the 19th century are full of advertisements that Mrs. So-and-so of this city, her husband came, his last known address is in New York, this, or Boston. Does anyone know who he is? So there were rabbis who wanted to come up with some sort of solution to this aguna crisis. And this aguna problem lasted from the end of the 19th century until modern times. Now we have the RCA prenuptial agreement. One of the rabbis in France, now these were not in France, these were not Gedolei Torah, these were not great Talmidei Chachamim, these were modern type of rabbis. Well, he suggested that, and he's the first one to suggest, and then this becomes a constant theme over and over with different proposals, but he's the first one, a conditional marriage. That is, everyone who gets married on condition that, because we know that you can get married with a t'nai. The condition is that if a divorce is ordered by the government, that is, if you get a civil divorce, or if a divorce is ordered by a government, if the government orders, I can't remember, because the real issue was when they went abroad, the government would order the dissolution of the marriage, so I assume that would fall into it as well, or maybe that was just a later development, and the original one just dealt with the husbands who refused to give the wife a get. That's the same thing. If they refuse to give the wife a get, and the government issues a divorce, that's what this rabbi said, then the marriage would be regarded as invalid from the beginning. So let me repeat it again. You get married, there's a condition as part of the marriage, and we know conditions are okay, that if you get divorced or if the government orders that the husband has to issue a divorce, that the marriage is automatically void from the beginning, you're not married anymore, and therefore there's no aguna problem. And how could this be done? Well, it was alleged that those who marry under the authority or the approval of the rabbis, and the rabbis have the authority to uproot marriages, to do all these things, and the rabbis can set up this condition and give the authority to the government that if the marriage is a dead-end marriage, the government orders it ended and orders a divorce, the marriage from the beginning was never regarded as having taken place. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was strongly opposed to this, and he actually was the leading figure in opposition, shutting, because a proposal like this, which is going to affect the entire Jewish people, has to have approval, wide-ranging approval. And there were proposed conditional marriages by a number of great rabbis, including Rabbi Henkin, in later years, and they never got off the ground for a variety of reasons. You can look at Rabbi Meiselman's book on Jewish women and women in Jewish law. If you want to see an English treatment, Aviad Cohen wrote about this. There always were problems. Problems which they found, which would void the condition, all sorts of things. I don't want to get into it at the moment, but Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, he cared very much about Agunas, but it had to be halachically proper. We already spoke about that. I don't want to go into any more detail, how he was very involved in issues of the day with the government. You know, the government, the Maskilim even influenced the government to prohibit in 1895 the study of Talmud in the Cheder. So Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan had to be involved in all sorts of things. But the fact that he was this leader, this Posek Hador, didn't mean that people didn't disagree with him. And not only in his lifetime, we spoke about a few things, but even after his lifetime. Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, I'll just give you a couple examples. Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, who we'll deal with next semester, he disputed Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan in a certain matter, and shortly after that, he's sent to Siberia. We'll talk about his journey to Siberia next semester. To the end of his life, he believed that the reason he was exiled to Siberia, he was suffering this way, is because he had the chutzpah to dispute with Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan's specter. Rav Moshe Feinstein, however, wouldn't have regarded this as chutzpah. Rav Moshe Feinstein wouldn't have had any problem. He believed you can dispute anyone you want to, and he did dispute Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan. Just to give you one, I went looking and I found one good case. Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan rules that if you come late to davening and find that they're in Musaf, let's say Shabbos morning, you come late and you find that they're in Musaf, you daven Musaf with them, and then you later daven Shacharis afterwards. Rav Moshe rejects this, and he says, no, you have to go in the order. You daven Shacharis first, then Musaf. Okay, let me get back to what I said just to close up a few things. His name is Spector, Yitzchak Hanan Spector. So where does his son get the name Rabinowitz? The great-great-grandson of Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, who lives in Israel now, reports to, in the new edition of the Tshuvot of Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, the responsa, there's a biography at the beginning. And in there, they quote this grandson that he's called Rabinowitz because this means son of the rabbi, and he had another son, as is Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan had another son, Rabbi Yamin, named Rabinowitz. And this name was given to him by the government. When the government did a census, they gave him this name. It's a bit of a strange to figure out how that worked, but that's what he claims. Many people have claimed, I know that Rabbi Rakefet has said this on numerous occasions because I've heard him, that the reason Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz was called Rabinowitz was because there was a rule in Russia that when you went bankrupt and you started over, you had to change your name. Start afresh. That's what he said, and he doesn't know, I don't think, that Rav Tzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz's brother was also named Rabinowitz. I assume that he was correct, but then I think I found out where he got it from, and so we see he's not correct. Abraham Karp, American Jewish historian, wrote an article called New York Chooses a Chief Rabbi, and one of the possibilities of Chief Rabbi was the son of Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan. See, here's Rabinowitz. Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan suggested him as the rabbi, even though he would never see him again if he went there. Let me read you this sentence, which explains why the American community, they had the choice between Rabbi Yitzchak Rabinowitz, the Malbim, they settled on Yaakov Yosef, why they didn't want Rabbi Yitzchak Rabinowitz. They discovered that he had suffered business reverses and was unable to pay his creditors. That's known. He did suffer business reverses. He only went into Rabbonus because he went bankrupt. He had changed his patronymic from Spector to Rabinovich. His wife had become insane, and he had separated from her in a manner which left wide room for criticism. In other words, three separate things. He suffered business reverses and owed a lot of money. He changed his name, and they thought that was strange. Who changes their name? Unless you're running from something. And three, the issue with his wife. So it's not that he changed his name because he suffered business reverses. It's a totally separate thing. There's another famous example in modern times of a rabbi with a different name than his father. We mentioned him last semester. And that's Rav Chanuch Henech Aigis, the Marcheshes. Rav of Vilna, great Mizrahi Rav, on the basin of Rav Chaim Moshe Grzinski. His father's name was Edelman, Tzvi Hirsch Edelman, and his father was one of these religious maskilim of the sort that the Netziv and Ritz Elchanan were very happy to be around. He published many Svarim. He went to Oxford and published a manuscript. And Rabbi Zevin points out, as we said last semester, that typically these religious maskilim, their children become more modern, or even not religious. It's quite unusual to have a religious maskil like Edelman, and his son goes the other direction and becomes one of the Gedolei Yisrael. There's another heter that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan gave, which was well known in New York, although no one could ever, and this I'll mention Rakefet as well, he wrote about Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, a little piece, but he recalled when he was young, a child, the old people would say that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan gave a heter in the 19th century to go on the elevated train. If you didn't have to pay for it, if you paid ahead of time, or you, I don't know whether there was an Erev there, by Rabbi Siegel, whatever, however you carried the tickets, I don't know, maybe one direction was free, but he gave the decision that you could ride on these elevated trains, provided that the travel was inside the boundaries, the tchum. And no one, and Rakef has been repeating this thing for 30 years, 40 years, and no one's ever been able to come up with any proof, but he knew what he heard. There's a website called Erev Online. This guy's a real expert on the history of Erevin. And he found, in going through the old Yiddish newspapers at Evo, wherever he was, he found the actual report of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan's heter, which he did issue. Provided the travel was in the boundaries, provided the tickets were brought before Shabbos, and the traveling was for a mitzvah. So it was only if you're going to shul. And he writes that this is Shas HaTchak, it's an emergency decision, because Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was told that it was vital for the New York Jews. They live far away from shul and things like that. They needed to travel. So now, when I can send anyone who wants to see it, the link, we actually have the source, and although Rabbi Rakefet, as I said, was wrong when it came, apparently wrong, with the Rabinowitz, the reason for the name, he was dead on and correct, and what he heard in his youth from the old people in the Lower East Side, that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan gave that permission, that was correct. I'm going to keep going. I have about 5 more minutes. I'll go after 10, and then we will talk. I want to speak about Rav Sa'ir for a minute. I have his book here. Okay. We spoke about Rav Sa'ir. Rav Sa'ir, Chaim Chernowitz. Before I get to what I have to say about Rav Sa'ir, some of you might have seen this book. It just came out. Masorat Moshe. Look how thick this thing is. This is over 600 pages, put out by Mordechai Tendler, who was the secretary of Rav Moshe, who was close to him, took notes every single day on everything that happened. We are told in the introduction that this is, let me read it to you. When I saw this, just by looking at this book is full of unbelievable stuff. This book is just, this thick book of 600 pages is just 1 year's worth of material. It dates from, he would write down every single day everything that came to him. It goes from 19, Kislev 78 to Tishrei 79, not even 1 year. There are 20 other volumes as big as this one. So when this is all done, you're going to have 20 volumes of this. I only skimmed it, and the page I'm going to refer to you is Shimon, who I mentioned at the beginning, who talked about the Or Sameach, the Meshech Chachma. He called my attention to a past something on this page, something totally different, but it's on the page. And it shows you that Mordechai Tendler also doesn't know all that much about the history of the time. He says, Rav Moshe Feinstein told him once, or Rabbeinu told him, that once he met Harav Chernowitz, Shin Reish Nun. That is, he heard Rav Moshe say that he'd tell a story about how he met Rav Chernowitz. What Rav Moshe was saying was not Rav Chernowitz with a shin. Tendler doesn't even know who Chernowitz is, because he's not a historian, he doesn't spend. It's not Chernowitz, it's Chernowitz. As you can see, can you see here? Where is it? Yeah. Tetshin, Chernowitz, or sometimes just the Tzadi. You know the story is correct because he's quoting it, but he doesn't have the, doesn't know who, Chernowitz is. But he says, who was known as, he knows that he's called Rav Sa'ir, but he doesn't know his name. But Rav Moshe obviously knows who he was. So he says that Rav Moshe met Rav Tzair once, and Rav Tzair, who was significantly older than Rav Moshe, said to Rav Moshe Feinstein, you know, I'm also a Rav, but I'm a bit from the Sitra Achra. You know, I've sort of gone off the derech a bit. I'm no longer in your circles. Remember, he was the Rav of Odessa. He was a posek. He wrote Shivos. But now he says, I'm no longer in your circles. V'rabbeinu eshivon. What did Rav Moshe reply to him? She'im kach, Savir Makiv Asmo. If Rav Tzair recognized himself that he was a bit off the derech, lama lo chozer b'tshuva? Why doesn't he do tshuva? It's almost like a naive, a very simple, tamim, sort of innocent, beautiful in a way of looking at it. Rav Moshe is saying, Rav Tzair knew that he wasn't living the proper life. Here's someone who was a big Rav. He knew that he had left a little, but at least he recognized it, so then why didn't he do tshuva? But I think that's the whole point. Rav Tzair was not the simple Jew who knows what to do and isn't necessarily living up to it, and then come Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur do tshuva. Rav Tzair was a great Gaon and Talmud Chacham and a scholar. He had made an intellectual decision that he didn't want to live that life anymore. So, you know, this is in for the simple people. It's the synagogue they don't go to is the Orthodox synagogue, and they might sin, but they know come Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur they have to do tshuva. But for the intellectual, no, he's sort of moved beyond that. He's not, he's made up his mind in a different direction. But I think it's really cute that, you know, Rav Moshe, with his tzidkus, he's trying to figure out why, maybe Rav Moshe couldn't imagine that a Rav, who had been a Rav of a big city, and a Talmud Chacham, and a Posek, and a Mechaber Svarim, like Rav Tzair, he couldn't imagine that he just becomes, I'm not going to say he's Acher, because far from it, he wasn't a heretic like that. But he sort of basically just gave up the rabbinate, gave up, you know, his old frum lifestyle. I don't even know if he was a Shomer Shabbos at the end. And Rav Moshe wants to know why, if he realizes he's not living up to what he should be, why not do tshuva? So that's just something I saw today. It's going to take me a while to get through. I'll bring this on Pesach. I hope Pesach will have a lot of free time. I'll be able to get through this entire book. So getting back to Rav Tzair. He was in the Kolel Prushim, as we mentioned, that this Kolel in Vilna, in Kovno, and while there he got to know Rav Yitzchak Hanan very well. He wrote an article on him, and he did the Hesped on him, which was made him famous, but he wrote an article on him later on, in which he says that what distinguishes Rav Yitzchak Hanan from the other rabbis of the day was his focus on halacha l'maaseh. The typical Lithuanian rabbis, we have Lithuanian rabbis who write volumes of tshuvot, and if you look, responsa, if you look in that, nothing is l'maaseh. They call it responsa, but it's all theoretical stuff. Rav Yitzchak Hanan focused halacha l'maaseh. He also, Rav Tzair talks about how he arrived, his method of arriving in lenient decisions. He would build sfeikot on top of sfeikot, so that a d'oraita prohibition becomes a rabbinic prohibition, and then it becomes much easier to permit. He also used common sense, and Rav Tzair writes in English those words, common sense. And he states, the most importantly, Rav Yitzchak Hanan was not afraid to paskin. Sometimes poskim, or could be great poskim, but they're afraid. And Rav Yitzchak Hanan was, just like Rav Moshe Feinstein, was not afraid to take the responsibility upon himself. He also says something, it's hard for me to believe. I mean, he knew Rav Yitzchak Hanan, but he portrays Rav Yitzchak Hanan as entirely removed from the world, without knowing basic things. He tells a story about how there was a dayan in Odessa. He's one of the dayanim opposed to Rav Tzair. They had a machokas about a chalitza case, and he was able to convince Rav Yitzchak Hanan to give a heter. And Rav Yitzchak Hanan, the upshot is Rav Yitzchak Hanan didn't realize that Nikolaev, which is a Russian city, he didn't even know where it was. He didn't realize it was a couple hundred kilometers. He thought it was like on the other side of the world. I find that hard to believe. Rav Yitzchak Hanan Spector, the man who went to St. Petersburg, the man who was involved with the Maskilim, I can believe it about Rav Avadya Yosef. People know Rav Avadya Yosef says that he doesn't know where certain places are on the map. He spends his entire life in learning. But Rav Yitzchak Hanan was a communal Rav. I mean, I can't imagine. But if you look on page 149, 150 in Rav Tzair's autobiography, Pirkei Chayim, he tells that story. There's a lot more we could say about Rav Yitzchak Hanan. I'm telling you, I could spend another 8 weeks on him. We spent 7 weeks. We could go into various responsa. He has responsa dealing with Muslims, and believe it or not, he has responsa dealing with all sorts of matters of Shabbos and Kashrus, but our focus is mostly on the historical significance and things like that. And I think it's time to end. So we'll move on to another figure next semester. Before I take the questions and comments, this was a short semester. It was a free semester. Rabbi Kelman wants to open up Torah in Motion to more people. As always, I enjoyed it very much. I learned a great deal. We had new people on, which we've never had before. I learned from the people I always learn from. People like Bill and Baruch and Yecheskel and Chaim Meiselman and Yossi and many others. I see we have today Jonathan Hirsch, my good friend, who I learned much from him over the years, including recently in our discussions about Kitnios, as well as new people who've come for the first time, Shimon and a few others. I hope you'll join us again next semester. Welcome to our group. Let me now look on at the questions here, and I'll stay on until we answer the questions. But if you want to get off, I wish you all a nice Pesach, and God willing, we'll meet up again afterwards. So, okay, let me go down with these questions. Meiselman asked, do I have pictures of them? I don't know if you mean the rabbis or not. There are pictures of Rav Moliver. I don't know of any pictures of Rav Klepfish and the Yeshua Smalko. Oh, yeah, Meiselman. Moliver, oh, there's many pictures. Just plug in online, you'll see Moliver. There's lots of pictures. It's already been pointed out. Thank you. Okay, Meiselman Chaim asks, he doesn't, Rav Yitzchak Kahn doesn't deal with this issue of should the Moals be medical practitioners. That was Moshe Kunitz. He pointed out that Rashi says that you can't live in a city without a doctor, and he says because you need people to be Moals. But no one has ever said that you need doctors to be Moals, traditionalists, other than Kunitz. Baruch says that Mordechai Zimmerman, a famous American Moel, did Shimush and Mila in Vilna resisted as related as such? I'm not sure, Baruch. Related what? Related that they didn't, lots of Moels didn't do Matzitz at all, or they did it with the tube? You'll tell me. Rav Chaim Ozer's not happy about this, that they didn't do Matzitz. That was okay. Shimon said, Briskers also wear right over left. Okay. Shimon, I mentioned you. I thank you for pointing something out to me. Let's see. Meiselman's heard of Rasvardim and Rabinowitz when they have demonstration. When they have traveled through certain parts of Russia. Could be, but Tzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz is not a Sephardi. Ah, so Meir Rabinowitz says that Making of a Gadol says he did it to dodge the draft, which, that's interesting, and maybe his brother did it. I know that people did this. I even have in my family, when I interviewed years ago, you'd give one of the sons to another family, let's say a family that didn't have any children, because if you had one child, the child wouldn't be drafted. So if you had two sons, you give one of your sons, and temporarily he'd be raised with a different name. But, you know, I read Making of a Gadol. I don't recall that. I will check on that. Thank you. I should ask Meir, are you related to Rav Yitzchak Kahn Inspector? Because you have the same name, Rabinowitz. You realize, of course, it's a common name, but... what I told you about in the biography, it comes from the great-great-grandson of Rav Yitzchak Kahn Inspector. Yes, Rabbi Akiva Eger changed his name. Rabbi Akiva Eger changed his name because his maternal grandfather he so admired, so he took the name of his maternal grandfather. Those of you, and I hope some of you will come, if you're not listening live, you're listening, more people listen after the fact. On my trip this summer, you will see the grave of Rabbi Akiva Eger the Elder in Pressburg. Meiselman says Berlin changes his name to Bar Ilan and Chernovitz to Rav Tzair. No, Rav Tzair, he didn't change the name to Rav Tzair. Rav Tzair was his pen name. So even when he was an old man, he still was signing his name Rav Tzair. In Lithuania, you had pen names. Rav Tamarit was Achad HaRabbanim HaMargishim. Rav Binyamin Moshe Tomashov, he had a pen name. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, if I recall, had a pen name. That was a common thing. Well, he didn't change his name. Yeah, I haven't heard that Rav Moshe gave the heter for the Staten Island train, but you have plenty of people in Staten Island, starting with his son, that you can ask him. It's difficult to believe, because ever since the Reform movement, the Chassam Sofer and the others, although the Sephardic rabbis have often given permission for people to go to public transportation to get to shul and things like that, I'm unaware of any Ashkenazic rabbis who ever given this permission. Rabbi Soloveitchik was asked this question when Rakefet came back from Russia. And you had Jews who wanted to go to the synagogue. The Kural Synagogue was the only functioning one. And they wanted to know if they can go on the metro. And they could sew the ticket into their jacket. And Rav Soloveitchik said to him, he called him from Israel, and Rav Gorin gave the same answer, that you couldn't. But Rav Soloveitchik said, because of the conservatives, that they've permitted all these things, we can't even begin to think about whether we can permit this. And so I would be quite surprised if that is true. So you're saying Shimon, Rav Moshe gave Rav Tzair Musar. Well, it's not clear whether he gave him Musar. Yeah, he did. He said if he recognizes it, why doesn't he repent? But I prefer to think of it not just Musar, that Rav Moshe Feinstein was thinking in the way he thought, that what, you know, for him it's very simple. You know what the truth is, and you're not living up to it, so now you'll do better. But for Rav Tzair, it was much more complicated. He was one of these people, similar to Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg in a way, but he was torn in so many different directions. He never could find his place. He wasn't a maskil, you know, which a non-religious maskil. He wasn't just a simple rabbi. He was somewhere in the middle. He was a great Zionist. There is yet to be a work on him. Other than that, I mentioned that long book article, almost of a book size, like 100 pages or 90 pages in Hebrew, which came out in the volume of published by Ben Gurion, Jewish Thought and Jewish Belief. But you could do studies of his Toldot HaLacha and his Toldot HaPoskim, which is really, it's a great work. It could only be written by someone. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg thought that Toldot HaPoskim was really a great piece of work. And I mentioned already how this Gurlitz, Menachem Mendel Gurlitz, when he published Shev Shematata, he plagiarizes. He takes it out of Rav Tzair, the stuff on Rav Avia the Katzos, or Avia the Heller, and just puts it in the introduction, doesn't even change a word, just lifts it. Now, Meiselman says, Tendler is trying to disguise it. I'm not sure what it is. Shimon says, Rabbi David Shustel, that's of Lakewood, once got stuck in a snowstorm on his way to Stanford and arrived after Shabbos, set in train. Or you could hire, we have had cases like that where they hire a cab, they get a non-Jew to take them. So Shimon's telling us in the Tziv was halacha l'maisa, mishdabura har shulchan, etc. Yes, you have to understand something though. Rav Tzair, he's trying to explain why he thinks Ritzah Hanan is the best, and he prefers Ritzah Hanan. Ritzah Hanan, in a way, he views him as a Rebbe of sorts. So, but you're right, yes. Rav Yosef Chaya Stern was also halacha l'maisa. But I guess he's saying he's more halacha l'maisa. I don't know. Meiselman says that he's heard rabbis say very ignorant things geographically, like San Francisco and L.A. are next to each other. Yeah. we've all heard rabbis say things which are ignorant, but, you know, then we don't pay them to be smart in geography and in math and science and things like that. If they are, it's an extra. We pay them to know Talmud and Halacha. Granted, it leaves a bad taste, and sometimes it hurts their efforts if the people, the students, realize that they're really pretty ignorant of basic things. But we've all seen it. Can't say next semester. Baruch, I want you to write, Baruch, what you meant by the Moel told you they did. You ask, do people still take him seriously? I guess it depends who you ask. There's Haskama there from the family, Rav Moshe, there's Rav Forst of Illinois, Rav David Feinstein, Rav Reuven Feinstein. Yeah, I don't want to get involved in the controversy, the conflict here, but What can I tell you? I don't want to get involved in that online.
It's a difficult thing and a hard thing to talk about. Reverend Zimmerman did with a tube, yes. Yeah, and Shimon tells us he heard from the Rosh Hashiva Brisk that Matzitza with the mouth is not an obligation. No one in Lithuania, as far as I know, with one exception, held that Matzitza had to be done with the mouth, not the Chazon Ish, not the Briskers, none of them. It's preferable. If that's the minhag, you should do it. But if there's a reason not to do it, you don't do it. Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. You never would expect this, but he's a Lithuanian. He writes that it has to be part, for the Hungarians, it's part of the mitzvah. It's an ikar part of the mitzvah, part of the mila. If you look in the Gemara, as we say in Yeshiva's Pashtos, it's not. It's simply a medical thing. And the Chasam Sofer himself said you don't need to do it, and it doesn't affect the mitzvah. But Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein says that this is such a revolting thing to do, mitzitza b'peh, that no one would come up with this on their own. And therefore, unless it was part of the mitzvah given to us, we never would have imagined this, and never, even for refuah, you never would have done this. And therefore, it must be part of the mitzvah. But that is not just a minority opinion, it's an opinion of one in Lithuania. If you go to the Hasidim in Hungary, I won't say in Hungary, because in Hungary, the non-Hasidim also didn't hold it as a requirement. Although they did it, but the Hasidim really made it into a big thing. Granted, the Maram Shik spoke about it, but that's in opposition to his own Rebbe, the Chasam Sofer. So I think, and Katz has written on it, you have to see some polemics here as well. The reform we're trying to get rid of, Matzitza, and that would have been the first step they thought to getting rid of Mila altogether. A few more questions I'll take. Meiselman says he remembered Neri Yisrael used to do it. Yeah, used to do it with the tube, but not anymore. Again, this is no chiddush. This is standard. I, in my life, have never, ever seen Matzitza done with the mouth. I've never seen it, because in my circles, no one ever does it. The new blog is going up. It's already up. Bill says, Chela Ches has endorsement from Rav David and Rav Reuven Feinstein. I'm talking about this new book. Mesoras Moshe, it's called. Yeah, the Mabit. Moshe Ben Yoma Tamashov. That is the grandfather of Jerry Blitzstein. No. Rav Tzair was off the derech. He was not. He wasn't just non-Haredi. I don't know if he was a Shomer Shabbos or not. Could be, but he definitely was not part of the wider Orthodox world. Okay, well, two more things, then I'm going to have to go. Shimon tells, I repeat these for those people who listen. As I said, many more people listen, not live. There's a famous story of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who kept the second day of Yom Tov. He arrives in Jerusalem from Bnei Brak by bus, in accordance with his teacher's psak, that this is permitted. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach reminded him of the Tchum, and he needed to remain. Okay, very good. Chernovitz, yes. Tendler heard him say Chernovitz, and he thought it was spelled with a shin, but it's actually spelled ch. No, the Shev Shematita does not plagiarism. They published an edition. And this Gerlitz is the same one he published the Chidushe Rav Chaim Soloveitchik on, was above Metzia, which somehow he got a hold of, and that led to from my Meiselman and some of the other people in Israel coming out with an attack on him, saying that he didn't do a good job. First of all, they don't know how he got the manuscript, and second of all, they came out with a booklet. They showed that he missed lines and words. But there's an introduction in there, which all the yeshiva guys, I'm sure, bought it up. They love this. There's an introduction on the Derech of Limud of the author, Rabbi Leib Heller. And if you look at it, you think, wow, this is great. What they don't realize, until it was pointed out in the journal Moria, is that this was lifted from Rav Tzair, word for word, and put in the introduction. But they couldn't say it came from Rav Tzair because... So then what does Gerlitz do? He's been exposed as a charlatan here. So he publishes a response in Moria after he was attacked, saying that, well, no.
He didn't say it came from Rav Sa'ir, because Rav Sa'ir, you can't say that. And it's not really plagiarism, because Rav Sa'ir is the plagiarizer. Everyone knows, he says, that Rav Sa'ir never wrote this book of his. He hired a Talmud Chacham to write it. It's unbelievable. And therefore, since Rav Sa'ir took it without acknowledgement from this guy he hired, I took it from him. Obviously, Gerlitz just made this thing up. What do you mean, Rav Sa'ir? Rav Sa'ir was a writer from his youth. What a writer he was. Every time these guys are caught with these sorts of plagiarisms, we saw it with Rabinovitz. Nassim David Rabinovitz. He took a very nice book on the Talmud by a Reform rabbi, the first book ever written on the Talmud in English. He took off the title page, he put his name on the title page, and he gets a haskama from Rav Avadya Yosef and Rav Aaron Feldman, the only two haskamas in history ever given to the work of a Reform rabbi. And then it all blows up. And, you know, if you think today, I mean, it doesn't measure up to the controversy he's involved in now and his problems, but this was a big, big problem when it happened. Someone told me he lost a Rabbonus in Baltimore because of this, but we, unfortunately, in our world, or in maybe not my world, but in the world of some of the people listening to us, there are people who believe that it's okay to just take the writings of someone else and use them. Yeah, I agree with you, Meiselman, that how could the Rabbi Silicon Inspector, he traveled from city to city. He's not some guy who just stayed in his village. He used to go on a train and then travel in the however they traveled. It was a train by then. To St. Petersburg, other places. You're going to tell me you didn't know where cities were? Shimon says the Chasam Sofer didn't print a tshuva on Metzitza Pe. Well, he didn't print it, but he sent it. He sent it to his student, the Rav of Vienna, and the student, the Rav of Vienna, printed it. Now, the family never included it in the book, in the tshuva to the Chasam Sofer. And some people think the reason they didn't include it, Rav Osner speaks about this as well, is because, precisely because it was a Shas Adchak, it was an emergency measure. And they didn't want people to get the idea that you can just get rid of Metzitza. But confronted with a situation where there was a medical problem, he permitted it. Okay, well, thank you all very much, and I look forward to hearing from you and seeing you. And if anyone else has anything to write, please send it to me. Just quickly, Kashkin, Rabbi Yeager changed to mothers since she was very important in his community, but he didn't change his mother. He changed to his mother's father's name, and he felt a connection to it. Maybe it's because he felt a connection to his mother, but this was a great rabbi, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the elder. He, too, by the way, has non-Jewish descendants. One of my colleagues at the University of Scranton told me when I first met him years ago that he's descended from Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the elder, not Rabbi Akiva Eiger that we usually think of, the father-in-law of the Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the elder. And he's very proud of this. But he's not Jewish. Okay, good night, everyone. Have a very nice Pesach, and look forward to seeing you when we get back.